Welcome to the St. Mark's Lutheran Church by the Narrows podcast channel. Today's podcast comes from our Sunday Forum series, To Give You a Future and a Hope, led by Pastor Mark Gravrock. If you would like to view and download the slides made to accompany this forum, there is a link available in the episode description. And now, here's Pastor Mark.
Gracious God, we thank you for your utter commitment to this broken world of ours. And thank you, God, that your vision is so much greater than ours. Be with us now. Let your Spirit open us to your vision. Open your word to us and to one another. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Before we get going, I've been asked to make an announcement there for folks who are interested in the Mexico mission trip that will be taking place this summer. There is an informational meeting that's going to happen today at 11 o'clock up in the fireside room. So right after our time together, you can grab another cup of coffee and head up to the fireside room and learn about the Mexico trip. That's today. We have been, for these 5 weeks, we are looking at the brokenness of our world, at our creation crisis, at the violence in our world, and the divisions that are going on all over the place, all of which make us feel pretty hopeless, and asking the question, in the midst of such a broken world, what realistic hope does the Bible offer us beyond our feel-good Bible verses? We spent some time with our feel-good Bible verses the first time, and I'm not dismissing those in the least because they're important. But I tend to run to them quickly without thinking of the bigger picture. The first time we were together, we spent looking at the God of the flood. And if you got nothing else out of that first time, I hope you got this, that in the wake of that flood story, God commits God's self to this broken world in a way that's clearly deeply painful for God, that God now accepts this violent, broken world and says, I'm committing to it regardless, in perpetuity. I will not abandon this world. And so gives us the emblem of the bow, the rainbow, as a sign of that commitment, which is also a sign of God's renouncing the weapon of war and choosing a different pathway in how God's going to do this. Coming out of that also, then, God calls Abraham and Sarah. God calls this family, and we ask the question, why? What's the purpose in calling this one family out of all peoples of the earth? What does that mean in the context of God's commitment to a broken creation? And then following that, the call of Moses to carve this people of Israel out of their slavery in Egypt. And we saw hints that God has done that with a couple of other nations also. What's God's purpose, besides just freeing a people? What's God's purpose in carving out a people? What is the role of the people of God in the context of God's commitment to a broken creation? Last week, we moved toward the prophets. And there we saw God getting involved in the messy stuff of the life of Israel. If God has called people of Israel, this people, to be somehow God's partner and agent in God's commitment to the broken world, what happens when we, God's people, get off track? And so the prophets come to recall us to the center of what this project's going to be about. And that amounted to two things over and over again. It amounted to God's call for justice for the most vulnerable, that this be a people who's committed to care for the most vulnerable, and a faithfulness to who our God is. That was last week. And last week, of course, we answered all the questions you had about prophets and end of the world and everything else that goes along with that. Next week, we're going to be moving to Jesus. We're going to see what in the world Jesus has to do with this whole thing. Today, I want to step back and take a bigger picture. We'll be primarily in the book of Job today. Now, some of you have shared this. This will be somewhat a rerun from some other stuff that we've looked at the end of Job, although we've looked at that in a different context, replacing that strange vision at the end of Job in the context of this big picture of God's creation. So a bigger picture. Here's the thesis paragraph. What if this is not all about us? What if chaos is part of God's beloved creation? What if all creatures matter just as much as we do? What if we all were to die off and insects took over the planet? What does it look like to see our damaged world from a larger than human perspective? We're going to answer all of those questions today. I intended to have us all sing this song this morning. My voice is still not back to full where I want it to be yet. This is based on Julian of Norwich's visions in England in the 14th century. In one of her visions, she sees this thing in the palm of her hand, this small round thing in the shape of a hazelnut. And she asks God, "What is this?" And God says, "This is everything. This is the entire creation. I hold it in the palm of my hand, precious and fragile, and I care for it." This song is based off of that. I'll sing you a verse, and then I'll give up and read the others. What is this in the palm of my hand? Small and round like a hazelnut. Small and round in the palm of my hand. What is this? Fragile, beautiful, and small. Fragile, beautiful, and small. What is this like a hazelnut? This is all in the palm of my hands, all that is made like a hazelnut. Cosmos, earth in the palm of my hand, this is all. Fragile, beautiful, beloved, held in my love like a hazelnut. All shall be well in the palm of my hand, all manner of things shall be well. Evil and wrong in the palm of my hand, all shall be well. Fragile, beautiful, and small, all shall be well, like a hazelnut. To get us started this morning, I'd like to have you imagine that the whole globe, the whole planet, is one living, breathing, conscious being. Okay. Now, there are some philosophies out there and some thoughts that the planet does, in fact, have a consciousness. And I don't know what the truth is about all that stuff. Can't prove it by the Bible. When I look in the Bible, what I see is things like the earth singing out for joy and the mountains rejoicing and the trees clapping their hands, all that, which we typically read as personification, all of nature praising God and rejoicing in God's deliverance. But I don't get any sense in the Bible that the Bible ever looks at the whole planet as one living, breathing being. So I'm not going to ask you to believe that, but I'm going to ask you to play with it for a moment. Imagine that you are Earth, that you are the planet. You've been around for quite some time. You have endured all kinds of things. How many million years ago was the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs?
60?
I was thinking it was about that, but I figured you'd know. 60 million years ago, this asteroid hits the Earth, hits you, and this world of the great reptiles is wiped out. And you start over again. New things. Mammals take over the planet now. You've endured all kinds of crises and catastrophes. You've also enjoyed rhythms. Rhythms of ice ages and warming times and movements throughout planetary history. Part of your life has been tectonic plates moving around your surface. Volcanoes growing, mountains building, all of those kinds of things. So imagine now that you are Earth. You are this planet. And you're looking at what's happening on your surface today. Here is this human race, destroying one another and destroying the fabric of your own being. If you are the planet, what do you want to do?
Spit them off.
Spit them off.
I don't think the planet cares.
You don't think the planet cares?
Because the planet will endure
and the planet has been through times, if you watch the PBS series, where it had, you know, nothing but volcanic, huge masses of lava running all over the place and hellscape on Earth. So I think the planet doesn't care.
The planet doesn't care
because it's going to be there. It's going to win. It's going to win no matter what. It'll survive.
Sure, I've got this pimple here, but I don't care.
That's right.
It'll go away.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, this is like the fourth or fifth time this has happened. Okay.
Okay. Anyone else? You are the planet. What do you want to do?
I'm going to give up gravity for about a week and a half.
you're going to give up what?
Gravity.
I'm going to give up gravity for a week. I love it.
That would be great. That would do it.
Okay. What would be the best for the Earth in terms of the human race right now?
Gone.
This one species has become particularly problematic. This one species is destroying the systems of the Earth itself, destroying other creatures. Maybe time to slough this one off.
I think we overestimate our importance. I mean, yeah, we make problems and we help solve problems, but I don't think it's cosmic. What's happening? I mean, it's like ants fighting each other.
Like ants fighting each other. We overestimate our importance.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. I just have a slightly different take. I feel like the Earth is weakening and hoping we pay attention, because I actually feel like Earth, we're a part of it, and it cares.
We are.
Not in the empathetic way, but maybe that sentient.
The Earth is weeping and hoping that we pay attention.
I guess from my perspective, I can see all of those, but what if Earth wants us to go out and make other Earths other places? We can go to Mars or another, go out and take what we have here other places, and Earth wants that, and that would make more Earth.
I'm going to send my children out to be fruitful and multiply.
Maybe that's what Earth is looking for.
Yeah. Well, we've done such a good job here.
I mean, I do think that we've done. I mean, there is and I can't remember where I heard this, but that we have actually now, there's some geologists that are saying that we are now the sixth or seventh
Earth.
In other words, when we started with coal and things, we changed it. We have now entered a new geologic age that where we are changing the Earth and doing that. And I mean, for all my facetiousness, I think but it's been a long time coming, and I think we can and should learn how to do things better and repair. And I mean, it took us a long time to chop down all the trees, but we did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took several, all of Europe used to be forested, the Midwest used to be forested, and they're gone.
That's the Earth first, we'll log the other planets later.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a matter of balance and change, and the Earth is used to change, but we're not doing a good job of stewardship.
Okay.
So, I mean, and terraforming Mars, hey, it's going to happen.
Here.
So, I'm going to speak for that. All the mothers out there, did birth, was that totally cool? Did that not change? Did that not hurt? I mean, it's a question of relevant. It all depends on what and your perspective is.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has a way to look at it that could be, you know, we're a cancer on the Earth, but it's also possible that, all depending on what our perspective is, maybe we're something that's necessary to bring out the next thing that is better. I don't think that there's any way that anyone currently living now can know what's the right thing or where we are supposed to be going.
Right.
We are seeing a tiny, tiny picture of a much larger thing that I don't think that we'll be able to see.
We are. We could go all kinds of places with this scenario, but I wanted just to entertain that thought for a moment. Because the Earth is dynamic and has gone through all kinds of eras all the way along. And there are plenty of biologists out there that will talk about if the human race expends itself and we turn the planet into a place that we can no longer survive on the planet itself will survive. Once the human race is gone, it will take geological eras for it to happen, but the planet will self-correct and find new balances and new, just as once the dinosaurs were gone, the mammals came along and a dominant set of creatures comes on the Earth. It can happen again. There's no reason geologically, and there's no reason biblically to suggest that that's not possible. Now, that's not the way what you hear most of the time through the Bible. Most of the way through the Bible, it's pretty human-centered, isn't it? Most of the way through, it's the story of God's interactions with this one people and the neighboring peoples, and then Christ coming into the midst of that, and then how this whole process moves out into all of creation. But almost all of the Bible is focused on God's attention to the human race and our role and responsibility and life on this planet. Very rarely do you get a bigger picture. We'll get one today.
It's also a certain area of the planet.
That's right.
It's in the Middle East.
Norway.
That's, you know.
No.
Yes. Yeah, so it's quite limited in its focus. Yep. Okay. Creation versus chaos. Genesis 1. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void. Waste and void is the old translation. And darkness covered the face of the deep. And the wind from God, or the Spirit of God, hovered over the face of the waters. There's the beginning. Notice the void, notice the deep. And then God begins to make separations. This key Hebrew verb that comes in here, hivdil, shows up several times in Genesis 1. It'll reappear later. It's translated as separated, or divided, or distinguished. God separates things. Separates light from darkness. Separates the waters above the dome from the waters below the dome. Separates the dry land from the surrounding seas. And those acts of separation or division or distinction create habitable zones for life. Those are necessary for life to flourish, to have those bounded zones done by separations. The book of Leviticus, everybody's favorite Bible book. In chapter 10, God has Moses speak to Aaron and say, you are to distinguish, it's the same verb, you are to distinguish or to separate or set apart the holy from the common and the unclean from the clean. This begins 10 chapters of Israel's purity code. All the food laws, the birth and death stuff, all the different pieces that are part of Israel's purity code. And it begins here with distinguishing clean from unclean, beginning with animals. What are clean foods? What are unclean foods? At the end of those 10 chapters, you get this summary. I'm the Lord your God. I have separated you, same verse, same word, verb. I have separated you from the other peoples. You shall therefore make a distinction, same verb, between the clean animal and the unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I am holy, and I have separated you from the other peoples to be mine. Israel's, according to the Levitical purity code, Israel's own existence is to be separated and distinguished from other nations as a participation in the maintenance of the created order. By making the distinctions that the code calls us to do, we are also helping maintain the separations that keep creation in order. If we stop making distinctions, the world falls back into chaos. That's the notion. When we looked at this, when we've looked at this before together, we've looked at this stuff in the context of LGBTQ issues, of all of the sexual issues, gay and lesbian and transgender and all of those kinds of things that we've been struggling with for several decades now. All of that stuff in the Bible is rooted in this purity code. I'm not intending to go into all of that again, but here's where it's anchored, right here. Jesus, of course, does other things with it. Okay. Creation by battle. Everybody's favorite version of creation? There, in the ancient Near East, several mythological developments in the nations surrounding Israel believed in creation happening by battle. The German term Chaos Kampf, chaos battle, chaos war. The creation happens by a battle. Here is the Babylonian version. The Babylonian sun god Marduk conquers the monster Tiamat. Tiamat is a representation of the salt water, of the great deep, of the oceans. That's what she, it's a she in this version. She is the chaos monster of the waters, of the wild waters. So Marduk battles her and conquers her and splits her apart, puts part of her above and part of her below, and there, you notice there's the firmament that you get in Genesis. Some of it's up there, some of it's down here, other parts of her become parts of the created order, and then creation flows out of that. Her name Tiamat in Hebrew is Tehom, which is the word the deep in Genesis 1. The Spirit of God hovered over the face of Tehom, the deep. Here's the Canaanite version. Canaanite version has the god Baal battling the monster Lotan. This monster is a he, to get the genders out there evenly. Baal, who's the storm god, has to battle the chaos monster, the monster of the chaos waters. Lotan, he's called, or sea, or the deep, or several different terms for him. Every year, Baal has to battle him and conquer him, and that's what makes creation happen again every year. So on New Year's Day, the battle has to happen all over again, and if Baal wins, we have another year of created order. Otherwise, creation falls into chaos. Some years, Baal is up to the task and does it pretty well. Other years, he's not, and he has to ask his sister to do it. Her name is Anat. So sometimes she's the one who battles Lotan, but year after year, creation has to happen brand new. Lotan is the same as in the Bible's word, Leviathan, or Leviathan. So here's the Bible's chaos monster. This is the surrounding peoples, Babylonians and the Canaanites. Israel was thoroughly familiar with this mythological theme. Psalm 74. Psalm 74 starts off with the first 11 verses are a description of our lament that we have been conquered, our enemies have beaten us, they have destroyed the temple. This is likely reflective of the Babylonians destroying the Jerusalem temple. God, everything's come undone, and we don't know when this is ever going to be solved. But then, starting in verse 12, yet, and now the psalmist calls to mind a piece of hope. Yet God, my King, is from of old, working salvation in the earth. You divided the sea by your might. If we stop there, what would you say this is about? Moses and the Exodus. You divided the sea by your might so that Israel could walk through. And I have no doubt that that is what the psalmist, what the readers and the hearers would be thinking at this point. But God, here's the evidence. You broke us out of Egypt. You took us through the sea, divided the sea by your might. But if you keep going, look what's parallel to it. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. Do you remember any dragons in the Red Sea in that story? We probably are talking about the Red Sea incident but we're talking about it in the same language as this chaos battle of God battling the chaos monster and defeating it. And so when God broke open the sea so Israel could pass through, the dragons and the Leviathan in the sea were killed and cut up as food for the creatures in the wilderness. And then what flows from that, oh, there's the monster. You cut openings for springs and torrents. You dried up ever-flowing streams. Yours is the day, yours also the night. You established the luminaries and the sun. You have fixed all the bounds of earth. You made summer and winter. What flows out of defeating the chaos monster? The created order. The seasons. The life-giving waters. Day and night. As a result of beating the chaos monster. This is good Canaanite theology. You'll see this monster showing up several other places too, especially in Isaiah and the Psalms and Job. Isaiah 27:1, on that day the Lord with a cruel and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan the fleeing serpent, Leviathan the twisting serpent, and God will kill the dragon that's in the sea. That's all you get. There's nothing more after that. What is this promise telling you? This is future.
The Lord's in charge.
The Lord's in charge. If we're talking Leviathan, what do things look like right now?
Not good.
Not good. Chaos. Lord, our world is in chaos. Things aren't working out the way they ought to work. And Isaiah says, the day will come when God will slay Leviathan.
He just doesn't say when.
What's that?
He just doesn't say when.
He just doesn't say when. Isaiah 51, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces? There are two Rahabs in the Bible. One of them is the prostitute in Jericho who saved the spies. This is not that one. They didn't cut her in pieces. Okay. The other places, the other Rahab, and I can't remember, one of them is Rahab and the other is Rahab. So I can't remember which one's which. But Rahab, this Rahab, is another name for Leviathan or the chaos monster, but always in an Egyptian context, with reference to Egypt somehow. So here, was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to cross over? The last line tells you what we're talking about, right? It's the Exodus. But all of that imagery, Rahab, the dragon, the sea, the great deep, is all the imagery of this creation battle, creation by battling the chaos monster. Notice how often the parallels, by the way, are the sea and the great deep. In the Bible, the sea then becomes an emblem of utter chaos. And that's why when you get the disciples crossing over the Sea of Galilee, and this storm comes up, and everything's getting wild, and they're terrified, and they wake Jesus, and Jesus calms it with just a word, and they say, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? That's reflecting the chaos battle as well. Who is this Jesus that he can conquer Leviathan? That he can conquer the chaos monster? It's also why when you get to the end of the book of Revelation and it says the sea was no more, I've never liked that line because I like the sea. But this is what it's saying. Chaos will be no more. Psalm 89, you rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. You crushed Rahab like a carcass. You scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. And then look what follows. Out of the battle comes creation again. The heavens are yours. The earth is also yours. The world and all that's in it, you have founded them. Here's my favorite Leviathan passage from Psalm 104. All this wonderful looking at all the elements of creation. Yonder is the sea, great and wide, creeping things innumerable are there, living things small and great. There go the ships, and there's Leviathan, who's there for what purpose? to sport in it. So here with this imagery of the chaos battle, and in Canaanite myth, it has to happen every year. Baal or Anat has to defeat this monster every year for creation to happen. And what is Leviathan in God's eyes? My rubber ducky. Okay. With it, I want you to hear. I want you to hear and see this imagery that's here in the Bible. Think back to the creation story itself, back in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. The earth is waste and void. Darkness is over the face of Tohum, the great deep. The Spirit of the Lord is hovering over the face of the waters. And God starts separating light from darkness, the waters above from the waters below, the sea from the dry land, so that there are habitable zones for creation to take place. There's the chaos battle. Only, how much battle do you find in Genesis 1? All God does is speak. This is playing with that Babylonian myth. All God has to do is speak. There's no battle that has to happen. God just speaks. Everything falls into place, upheld by God's speech. Okay. Let me pause there. Thoughts, questions, comments before we move into Job?
The battle is between the lines of God's speech.
The battle is between the lines of God's speech. Yep. By the way, if you're playing with, if you're reading Genesis 1 with an eye toward surrounding myths, when you get down to the creation of the sun, moon, and stars, the names for sun and moon are actually the names of other gods in the area. So Shemesh, the word for sun, is a god in Canaanite and Babylonian myth. And so in Genesis 1, and God created the big light to shine over the day and the little light to shine over the night. He just wiped out some other gods' names. It's kind of fun stuff. Book of Job. I won't go through everything that I put on the sheet there for you. If you know the book of Job, or if you don't, it's important to know those first couple of chapters, because those first couple of chapters set up the story. I put down there that it's an opening cartoon, because it is drawn out of proportion. And for to start with, here you've got this Job. He's not even an Israelite, by the way. He's from further east. And he is perfect. He's flawless in his life, faithful in everything he does. Nobody in the Bible except Jesus is like that, okay? So when you see somebody lifted up as perfect, you should be scratching your head already. But it's important to set it up this way, because whatever this contest between God and the Satan is in chapters 1 and 2, it's very clear that Job is blameless. Job's going to be arguing all the way throughout the book that he's blameless and he doesn't deserve what's happening to him. And chapters 1 and 2 say he's dead right. Chapters 1 and 2 also tell you that because this is a wager between God and the Satan, which is God's quality control engineer at this point, because it's a wager, Job cannot know what's going on. If Job is ever told what's going on, it spoils the whole wager. Well, that's important to know throughout the whole thing.
Doesn't it make God seem kind of cynical, though?
Does it make God seem kind of cynical? Yes. Which is why, for me, it's important to say this is a cartoon. That this is not theology. This is not a declaration of God's nature. This is a painting of a picture that sets up the scene. That's a whole conversation we could have as well. As you get into the debates, this language of the chaos battle keeps reappearing in the language of Job and his friends. So chapter 3, when Job first is lamenting, when he finally starts to speak what he really feels, the first thing he wants to say is, I wish I had never been born. This is awful. I wish that when I had been born, somebody had just kind of tossed me out or let me die or whatever, so that this never would have happened. So let those curse the day of my birth who curse the sea, those who are skilled to rouse up Leviathan. I have no idea who these people would be that can rouse up Leviathan or curse the sea, but that language is there. Let those who have power over the chaos elements, let them curse my birthday. Chapter 7, Job cries out to God, who do you think I am? Do you think I'm the sea or the dragon that you set a guard over me? God, you're treating me as if I were the chaos monster. Why are you doing this? Chapter 26, God with power stilled the sea. With understanding, God struck down Rahab. By God's winds, the heavens were made fair. By God's hand pierced the fleeing serpent. There's that same language we've been hearing. And Job and his friends keep referring to this. It's an underlying theme about the chaos battle going on. There's a reason for that, I think. What's happened to Job's own life?
Gone downhill,
gone into chaos. The lines that should be holding Job in a wonderful place have fallen apart. And Job's own created order has come undone. His life has turned into chaos. You ever felt like your life had been turned into chaos? Nobody knows exactly for sure when this book was written. There is a number of scholars suggest that it was written in reflection of Judah's loss of Jerusalem. Once the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem, carted us all off into exile, that this may be written around the same time. In which case, we've got another very different way of thinking and feeling what in the world we're going through, the chaos and destruction we've been going through, but it's placed in a very different context, dealing with the issues that we don't dare speak out loud ourselves. Maybe, I don't know if that's true or not. In any case, during the exile, Israel went into chaos. Their life fell into chaos. God, where are you? God of the created order? None of this is working. What's going on? Job, all the way through, is begging for God, begging for an audience with God. God, let me plead my case with you. You've done me wrong. You have dealt me injustice. I don't deserve any of this. Remember, Job is right about that. And God can't tell him so. With the structure of the whole argument of the book. So here in the last chapters of Job, God addresses Job's own issue. So chapter 38, hey Job, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? How many of you have wished that God would step in and shake the skirts of the earth so that a few key wicked people might be shaken out?
Daily.
Take it daily?
Daily.
Yeah. You don't have to fess up and you don't have to name names. All I want to do is ask you if you felt that. Yeah, that's what Job is feeling. And God says, basically the kind of attitude that God gives Job in these chapters is, Job, I'm God, you're not. Who do you think you are? Which is not very comforting. Okay, who are you, Job? Have you ever taken the skirts of the earth and shaken the wicked out? Chapter 40, you get another one. Job, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me so that you may be justified? Deck yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, your wrath. Look on all who are proud and abase them. In other words, Job, I want to challenge you to do what you're asking me to do, to fix the earth the way that you're asking me to. Look on all who are proud and bring them low. Tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then I will also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can give you victory. A little sarcastic. Job, are you ready to play God? Do you think you understand the big picture well enough that you could step in and play the role that you're asking me to play? Thoughts? Let me pause there.
If he's asking, if Job is asking God to take care of it and to fix it, this is really a misdirected statement in my mind.
It's a misdirected statement. It doesn't fit Job's need.
Well, yeah. It's puzzling.
It is. That's part of what's so unsatisfying in terms of our own hunger to see things set right as we read these chapters.
You want to say anything about the role of Job's friends?
All I'll say is that they were really good for the first 7 days when they sat with him in silence.
Right.
It went downhill after that. There's plenty more we could say, but part of that is that Job and his friends are really all believe the same thing. They all believe that God runs this world with justice and ought to, that you ought to reap what you sow, only it's not working. So Job says, God, this isn't working. What's going wrong? And Job's friends say, well, it works. Job, you must have done something really, really bad for this to be happening. Okay. So there is a deeply unsatisfying level of these chapters of the book of Job when God speaks. And it's because God, in these chapters, does not speak to Job's question in any kind of direct way, and cannot, by the structure of the whole story, God cannot address what's really going on, because that would destroy the match. And so Job is left in the place that all human beings are left, wondering what in the world's going on, God. And God's not answering, not in any clear way. But God does answer here. This is William Blake's, one of his series of lovely sketch of images from the book of Job. This is when God finally responds out of the whirlwind. So God responds. First thing God says is, Job, I'm God, you're not. And then, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. A little sarcasm. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Job, were you there when I first created this whole thing, designed it all as this masterpiece? You were there, weren't you, Job? You know what this is all about. And the very next thing that shows up in God's kind of parading the creation before Job has to do with the sea. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb? You stop right there. With everything you've heard, what's the sea all about?
Chaos.
Leviathan, the great deep, the necessary separation of parts of the creation so that life can flourish. This chaos monster that has to keep being beaten back is the sea. Who shut in the sea with doors? Notice it needs to be contained, right? When it burst out from the womb. From whose womb? Say.
Maybe chaos was part of the creation before the creation?
Was chaos part of the creation before the creation? Let's go on with this passage. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band. What role is God playing?
Midwife.
Midwife? Or mother? Chaos is God's baby. Chaos is God's own child, God's own creation, that God nurtures, or if God's the midwife rather than the mother, that God nurtures and wraps in swaddling bands with clouds and deep darkness, which are also images of chaos and fear. I wrapped it up in swaddling bands and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, okay, this child needs to be disciplined. Thus far shall you come and no further, and here shall your proud waves be stopped. There is a boundary between the sea and the dry land. There's a place beyond which the seas are not supposed to come until, of course, Antarctica all melts, and then it's going to come anyway. Here is God's child, God's chaos child, that God nurtures and loves and sets boundaries to as part of that love. That's pretty potent. If you know already that the book of Job is immersed in this chaos battle language and sees the sea as the emblem of chaos, then the first thing you get in the parade of creation that God gives Job is chaos being birthed from the womb, being wrapped in swaddling bands, and being bounded. Thoughts? Where it goes on from there is now we get a whole a parade of, well, first, have you entered the springs of the sea, Job? Or have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the gates of deep darkness? The answer, of course, is no, I haven't, God. You have, but I have not. But that language, again, of the sea and the deep, now paralleled with death and deep darkness. And then starts this parade of weather patterns. So the next chapter and a half, you get these, the next chapter, most of a chapter, you get weather stuff. First light and darkness, then snow, hail, and east wind, then torrents of rain and thunder. And there's a lovely piece of that one, that the torrents of rain and thunder are to satisfy the waste and desolate land, which has people all over it, right? Empty of human life. Here God is nourishing the dry land that has no people on it. Is it just the people God cares about? Nope. Rain, dew, ice, and frost. Has the rain a father? Who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? Who has given birth to the hoarfrost of heaven? The language of birthing and of children runs throughout these passages. Whose parent is the dew? And whose parent does the dew have and the ice and the hoarfrost? God is its parent. Both father and mother now. Does it have a father? Whose womb did it come from? It came from my womb. I'm its father. These weather patterns are my children. Constellations. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades and loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Mazaroth? We don't know exactly what constellation that is in their season. Can you guide the bear with its children? Job, are you in a place where you can marshal the stars and the constellations around? The stars and their children. The stars have children. There are kids running through this whole pattern. Then flood, lightnings, storm clouds. With all of this, what kind of weather patterns are you seeing and what are you not seeing?
Sun.
No sunshine.
Spring.
No spring. No lovely days at the beach. They're there, kind of hidden in, but by and large, you're not getting sunshine and blue sky. The parade that God gives to Job is this parade of wild weather, threatening weather, that is nurturing and nourishing at the same time. And all of these weather patterns are God's children. Next, we start with a parade of critters. So once God's done with weather patterns, God starts with creatures.
Of course the cat would be.
That was Artemis, our cat back in Montana. We don't have a cat now, so I had to pull one from before. This is not the kind of critters we're looking at. Okay, so the lion, the raven, the mountain goat and deer, the wild ass, the wild ox, the ostrich, the war horse, and the hawk and eagle. Tell me what you see about these creatures.
No domesticated ones.
No domesticated ones.
Predators.
Predators? Predators, many of them predators, not all of them, many of them. The mountain goat and deer are not, and the wild ass, but many of them are predators, which makes them, in terms of the Levitical law, unclean. Predators are unclean. They eat blood. Okay?
What about the war horse?
the war horse.
That's well trained.
What's that?
It's well trained, but for.
Well trained, but for war.
Yeah.
In Israel's culture, the horse, as far as I know, only shows up as an emblem of war. As a war, the horse. In peacetime, you use donkeys. War is for battle, and they're trained for battle. So yeah, with these, many of them are, in terms of Leviticus, unclean. Most of them are wild. Like the ostrich. It's unclean and it's untamed and it's really stupid. It doesn't know how to take care of its own kids. It lets the eggs get trampled on the ground. The hawk, unclean. The war horse, neither unclean nor wild per se. It has been domesticated, but it delights in war. These are violent and wild elements of creation. And with many of them, if you read through the whole passage, the lion, and God cares about the young of the lion too. The young keep being referred to. The raven and their young. The mountain goat and deer and their young. The ostrich, which does not care for its young. And the hawk and eagle with their young. All the way through, here are these elements of creation that I delight in. And their kids. Okay. Where do human beings show up in all this parade of creation? One place and one place only. From there the eagle spies the prey, its eyes see it from far away, its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are on the battlefield, there are the eagles and the hawks. Where do human beings show up? Food lying there on the battlefield. Not a pleasant passage. Let me pause there and ask you what you're seeing, what you're noticing.
A womb.
Pardon me?
A womb.
The womb.
The humans aren't important.
The humans aren't important.
No, I mean, it seems like he's talking about all these things that, you know, hey, these are chaos control. How do you fit in? You're pretty minuscule in the scheme of things.
Who do you think you are, Job, with your petty troubles? You're not petty. He's lost everything. He's lost his kids and all that. But who are you, Jules, to think that you are more important than all of these other critters that come forth from my womb? It's not a comforting passage. Now, God's going to up the ante. So this is another one of Blake's woodcuts with God at the top, and then Behemoth and Leviathan, the two great monsters in chapters 40 and 41 of Job. So first, that's the behemoth on the top, who is designed after, I think, the hippo in this thought, and Leviathan down below. So, after God rebukes Job a second time, then God moves into, let me show you some more creatures. Let me show you behemoth. Behemoth is actually a plural in Hebrew. Behema, the singular, means a land creature, basically. It could be cattle, it could be any kind of land creatures. That's a behemah. The plural behemot means super critter, super land critter. Okay? Look at behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It's as important to me as you are. It's the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. Exactly what critter they had in mind, nobody knows for sure. The hippopotamus is a strong possibility, but the imagery seems to be based around the hippo. There's Leviathan. Sorry, there's Leviathan. So after God parades behemoth out there for Job, then God's moves on to Leviathan, who is the chaos monster. Chaos sea monster. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope on its nose and pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it make many supplications to you? Will it plead with you? Will it speak soft words? Will you play with it as with a bird? Or will you put it on a leash for your girls? There's a long description of Leviathan in there, and it's Some have, before the discovery of the Canaanite materials that show us the parallels in these other religions, in these other mythologies, the best people came up with was this is some kind of super crocodile or super alligator or something like that. But if you actually read it, it sounds alligator or crocodile-like, only it breathes out fire and stuff like that. What are we talking about?
A dragon.
It's dragon language. Okay. Now, it makes the deep boil like a pot. It makes the sea like a pot of ointment. How do you experience, when do you experience Leviathan in this world? When the sea is out of control. Yeah. The whole passage about Leviathan ends, on earth it has no equal. You heard that language before anywhere? On earth he has no equal, which is referring to the devil. Which is why you never stop with verse 1 of the Mighty Fortress, because the devil wins if you stop there. You've got to go on to verse 2 or more. Okay, that's where Luther got the language for this, straight out of Leviathan. He's a creature without fear that surveys everything that's lofty. It is king over all that is proud. Does it sound like God doesn't like this? God's really proud of this one. Have you seen my kid Leviathan?
Wow.
So, let me ask you, what kind of a vision is this? What role does chaos play in God's creation? How big is God's concern and God's embrace? And what role do human beings play? We've got at least 3 minutes. What do you have to say?
I think it replaced chaos with sin.
With sin.
Yeah.
Which is probably harder to control than chaos is.
Well, I like going back to Derek's idea of chaos and the whole birthing experience, the pain, the writhing, but out of that comes brilliance.
Yeah.
When I think of the earth that we live on and how fragile the earth is, if we go outside that little fragile area, it's extremely dangerous.
That's right.
The creation of the universe, crashing suns, black holes, suns.
And so kind of two things there. You've got the second thing you're talking about is the massiveness and wildness of the whole created order. And in that sense, it's enduring character. But on the other hand, that fragile zone of life, that tiny band of life that circles this planet, that if you step outside of it, you can't live. Well, life, on the one hand, is really fragile. And on the other hand, the big picture of God's...
And the whole big picture is what created this little band that we live in.
The whole big one created the little band. Chaos helped to create the habitable sphere that we live in.
And I keep thinking of the fact that there is a group of scientists I worked with for a while that, you know, kept talking about the Big Bang Theory and where's God in that? And I said, who's to stop God from going bang?
That's right. Or unbang.
Or unbang.
Well, and when he says bang, he created physics and all the math
exactly
that governs the movement as things expand.
But I will go ahead.
Well, I think of the chaos from a teacher who started the school year sick as can be and unable to teach. And when she came back, she told us about that time of chaos in her life and said, and her prayer was, why me? Why me? And finally, it dawned on her to ask, what is there for me? What do you have for me in this? And
what
it seems like chaos is that, in the way you revealed the scripture to us in that way, it's that birthing, painful birthing process out of which we grow and come to a more appreciation or fullness of life.
Thank you. Oh, we need to wrap up, and I know that you've got lots more to say, but as we finish today, I'd like you to place the whole big question that we've been talking about in this context. These last chapters of Job give us a vision of a created order that is far more vast and more glorious and deeply loved by God. Think of that hazelnut in God's hand. All of it, evil and wrong and everything else, all of it there in the palm of my hand, and all shall be well. I care for every last bit of it in the palm of my hand. God's compassion for God's baby, Chaos, and all the other babies that are part of this whole picture. And our thrashings and our strugglings are not lost to God's concern, but they're all wrapped up in that big picture. So in this context, for God back in Genesis 9 to say, this is now a violent world, and I'm committing myself to this violent world in perpetuity, and I will not abandon this world. That's some of the dynamics that we're facing. Though the earth shall change, though the mountains tremble, though the waters rage, you, God, are here. Though the nations war, though the peoples battle, though the empire falters, we will not fear. Once more. Though the earth shall change, though the mountains tremble, though the waters rage, you, God, are here. Though the nations war, though the peoples battle, though the empire falters, we will not fear. Next week we get Jesus. Thanks, everybody.